Since there was no barrier between us, I just asked him. "So, David," I began, still unpacking my clothes, "are you a hardcore Christian?" David looked amused. "Yeah, I guess I am." "You do realize that the Bible has been corrupted, right?"
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah, it's been changed over time. Everyone knows that." David looked unconvinced, but genuinely interested in what I had to say.
"How's that?"
"Well, it's obvious. For one, just look at how many Bibles there are. You've got the King James Version, the New International Version, the Revised Standard Version, the New American Standard Bible, the English Standard Version, and who knows how many others. If I want to know exactly what God said, how am I supposed to know which Bible to go to? They're all different."
"Okay.
Is that the only reason you think the Bible isn't trustworthy?" David's calm and controlled response was surprising. People were usually caught more off guard.
"No, there's tons of reasons."
"All right, well, I'm listening." Breaking away from my suitcase, I collected my thoughts. "There have been times when Christians take out whole sections of the Bible that they don't want anymore, and they add stuff that they wish were there."
"Oh yeah? Like what?"
"I don't know the exact references, but I know that they added the Trinity into the Bible. Later, when they were called out, they removed it."
"Oh, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about 1 John 5.
I had no idea what 1 John 5 meant, but I practically jumped him for admitting the flaw.
"So, you've known all along."
"I know what you're referring to, but I don't think you're seeing it right."
"How am I not seeing it right?"
"It's not that Christians are just adding and removing things, as if there's some grand conspiracy with people controlling the text of the Bible. I mean, let's just imagine for one second that someone did want to add stuff. Do you think he could just change all the Bibles in the world?"
"Well, maybe not all," I admitted, approaching my bed and sitting across from David. "But enough."
"Enough to what?"
"Enough to effectively change the text."
He looked unimpressed.
"Nabil, are you telling me that Christians the world over would just let someone change their holy texts? And that this massive change would not be recorded anywhere in history? Come on."
"Well, not the world over, but I can imagine someone getting away with it in a specific region."
"So you agree, then, that if there were an interpolation in a specific region, we would find copies of the Bible without that interpolation elsewhere in the world?"
"Yeah, I guess so."
"Well, there you have it," he said with an air of finality. "That explains the multiple versions of the Bible and the issue with 1 John 5.
What? I felt as if I had been playing a game of chess with David, and he had unexpectedly declared checkmate. "The fact that there are manuscripts of the Bible all over the world means we can compare them and see where changes have been introduced. It's a field of biblical study called textual criticism. If anything is changed, like the verse about the Trinity in 1 John 5, then we can easily find the alteration by comparing it to the other manuscripts. That explains the major differences between various versions of the Bible. But don't get the wrong idea. There are only a handful of major differences between them."
"What about all the minor differences?"
"Well, those are just stylistic differences in translation for the most part. There are different translations of the Quran, aren't there?"
"Yeah, but they're all using the Arabic text to translate, not foreign language transmissions."
"Well, it's the same with the Bible. Most of the differences between Bible versions are just matters of translation, not the underlying Hebrew or Greek." I let all this new information sink in, and I looked at David in a new light. Where did he get all this information? Why hadn't I learned this before? I found it all hard to believe. In the end, my incredulity won out.
"David, I don't believe you. I've got to see this for myself." He laughed.
"Good. You'd be letting me down if you didn't look into it further. But if you're going to do this right, you better bring it." I got up and started walking back toward my suitcase.
"Oh, don't worry. It's been brought."
After I finished unpacking, we focused on final preparations for the tournament. All the while, I kept thinking about our conversation. I was still fully convinced that the Bible was corrupt, but I had to deal with more advanced arguments than I had previously heard. I was excited to return home and dive more deeply into these matters. Chapter 22. Textual Evolution. Before long, we were back at school, catching up on classes. David was a double major in biology and philosophy, and I was pre-med. It turned out we were in a few of the same classes, chemistry and evolutionary biology. Sometimes being in classes together was a good thing. David and I studied chemistry together regularly with the mutual understanding that it was all-out war. We were trying to outdo one another. After every exam, our professor posted the grades outside the lecture hall,
and David and I would clamber over one another to see them. Because of our friendly competition, David and I always had the highest grades in the class. Other times, being in classes together was not a good thing. In evolutionary biology, David and I could hardly pay attention. The teacher made no attempt to hide her atheism, and we were both distracted by her side comments. Being strong theists, we found most atheist arguments petty and unconvincing. Whenever our professor said something with an atheist bent, we would turn to one another and make jokes about it, or about her. We were college kids, after all. On a particular day, after a brief pro-atheism tirade, she returned to teaching us about taxonomy, the classification of all living things into kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. I leaned over to David and whispered, "After much observation, I concluded that her hair has a life of its own. I'm trying to figure out what phylum I'd put it in." David responded with a serious tone, "That's a tough call, Nabil. It appears to have developed self-defense mechanisms reminiscent to those of scorpions. What do you think?" "Very astute, David. I would have said it looks more like moss or a lichen, but now that you mention it, it could very well be a sentient being." The next few moments were spent stifling laughter, and this kind of impertinent banter ultimately led me to drop the evolution course. We just couldn't focus when we were there together. As I went through college, I learned that evolutionary theory had actually crept into many fields. Biology, sociology, anthropology, communications, psychology, and even religious theory. Indeed, there were notes of evolutionary theory in the arguments I used against the Bible. I asserted that the Bible had been changed over time, altered in transmission by those in power according to their aims. Later, I would come to argue an evolutionary model for the Gospels, that the earliest Gospel, Mark, had a much more human view of Jesus than the later Gospels, and that Jesus' divinity in the Gospels gradually evolved. But for now, David and I were focused on the first point, the textual integrity of the Bible, specifically the New Testament. Like most Muslims, I was not concerned with the Old Testament nearly as much as I was with the New Testament. The way I saw it, the Old Testament mostly agreed with the Quran. It named many of the same prophets, it showed prophets going to war against polytheists, and it did not say anything about the Trinity. The New Testament is what really offends Muslim beliefs, so this is what we discussed. It was after chemistry class one day that David and I continued our discussion about the New Testament. "All right, David, I've been looking into textual criticism some more, and I've found problems. What do you have?" "Looks like I was right about whole sections of the Bible being interpolations. Bible scholars are saying that the end of Mark is not original, and neither is the story in John about the woman caught in adultery. You know, the story where Jesus says, 'Let he who is without sin cast the first stone.'" "Yeah, I know that story, and you're right, they're not original to the text. What's your point?" I was surprised he so readily conceded this point. "You don't see this as a problem? I mean, whole portions of the Bible are not actually God's word." "I know what you're getting at, but no, this isn't a problem. Don't you see? The very fact that we can identify these additions means that we can detect alterations." "True, but regardless of whether you can detect it, it means the Bible was altered." "Later manuscripts, yes. But so what if a later manuscript had alterations? It's not like anyone would consider a later copy more accurate over an earlier copy. The early manuscripts are the ones that matter, and we have many early copies of the New Testament without those interpolations." I considered his suggestion carefully. "How many, and how early?" "Well, we have manuscripts from the 2nd century in the original Greek, and dozens more in the 3rd century. In our possession today, we still have 2 full New Testaments from the early 4th century. If you want to see how much the Bible has changed from the 4th to 21st century, all you have to do is pull out manuscripts and compare." Now this was an interesting proposition. It took all of the conjecture out of the debate. I had to make sure I heard him clearly. "So you're telling me that we actually have whole Bibles from the early 300s?
"Yep."
"And how different are they from today's Bibles?" David looked me square in the eyes. "Nabil, modern translations of the Bible are based on those manuscripts." I considered his words, but the very fact that there were multiple versions continued to bother me. It meant that the words of the Bible were not agreed upon. "Aren't the exact words important, David? As a Muslim, I believe that the Quran is exactly the same as it was dictated to Muhammad. Not a single word has ever been changed. From what you're telling me, it seems like you think the exact words of the Bible don't matter." The words do matter, but they matter because they constitute a message. The message is paramount. That's why the Bible can be translated. If the inspiration were tied to the words themselves, as opposed to their message, then we could never translate the Bible. And if we could never translate it, how could it be a book for all people? I didn't know if David was challenging my view of Quranic inspiration, but what he said made sense. As I silently contemplated his perspective, he continued, "Nabil, I think we should take a step back for a moment and look at this a little more broadly. You are trying to argue that the Bible has been irretrievably changed, but first, you need to be more specific. There are 66 books in the Bible. What part are you talking about? When was it changed and how? Was it changed in any significant way?" I continued to sit in silence. My teachers had never taught me any specifics. They just repeatedly proclaimed that the Bible had been changed. I said nothing. "If you think that there has been a significant change, you should provide evidence of that. Conjecture is not enough. You need proof." Even though David was making plain sense, I didn't like being in a corner. I already told you, the end of Mark, a story in John, and the interpolation in 1 John 5 about the Trinity are all examples of how the Bible has been changed. And I told you, virtually no scholar considers those segments as parts of the Bible anymore. You need to show me a major change in something we actually consider a part of the Bible. I continued to fight. "Well, what if there are other parts like those three that we just haven't found yet?" "That's conjecture again, Nabil. What if does not constitute much of an argument? What's the claim? Where is the evidence? If there are no specifics, there's no argument." It was clear I was flailing. David leaned back and made his concluding point. When the books of the New Testament were written, they proliferated quickly. They were copied many times, with copies being sent far off to other Christians so they could read them as well. After reading them, those Christians often copied the books before sending them on. How exactly can this kind of proliferation of texts, without any central control, be uniformly and undetectably altered? How can someone corrupt the words? No one had control over Christendom until hundreds of years after Christ. We have dozens of manuscripts from before that time, and they are the same as today's Bibles. There is just no conceivable model for the New Testament to have been changed in any significant sense. No model that's consistent with the facts of history. I relented for the moment. "All right, let me sit on this for a while." David hadn't changed my mind because I knew in my very core the Bible had been altered. Yet for some reason, I couldn't figure out how. In the meantime, I decided to try a different approach, denying that the Bible was ever trustworthy in the first place. Chapter 23. Revisiting Reliability. It wasn't long before David was at our house, taking Ummi up on her offer. When I opened the front door for him, he made a beeline for the fridge, which amused Ummi tremendously. She found it endearing. But had he used his nose first, he would not have bothered with the fridge. Ummi loved cooking for guests, and as was her custom, she had a feast waiting for us on the table. She had prepared lamb korma, goat biryani, chicken makhni, beef nahari, and much more. I'm sure there must have been vegetables on the table, but I always ignored those. When we sat down to eat, David looked happily confused. We were starting with the nahari, a rich beef curry, but there was no silverware on the table. I showed David how to eat with roti, using my fingers to tear the flatbread and scoop up chunks of food. David gingerly followed suit. He made it through the meal without any mishaps, which made me wonder if God was with him after all. Soon we were in the living room, lazing on sofas and basking in the afterglow of our feast. David was lying on his back, staring at the ceiling. Though he had come over to study chemistry, I realized his guard was down, and this was the perfect time to push on the reliability of the New Testament. "For the sake of argument," I postulated from my chase, "let's just say that I agree the New Testament hasn't been changed." "Hallelujah," he mumbled, not moving a muscle. "Even if it hasn't been changed, that doesn't automatically make it trustworthy. In other words, how do I know that what it says is accurate?" David turned to me in mock surprise. "But Nabil, how can you ask such a thing? Doesn't the Quran say the Injil is the word of Allah?" It was clear that David had been studying Islam so he could understand me better, and he was right. My position was not common among Muslims, who often believe that the Gospels of the New Testament are the Injil. I'm not convinced the Quran was talking about the Gospels in the New Testament. Maybe it was referring to another book given to Jesus, one that we don't have anymore. I was proposing a view that I had heard espoused by Muslim debaters.
David considered this.
Well, I'll address your question, but I wonder if you're searching for ways to doubt the New Testament. The only Gospels that even come close to being from Jesus' time are the Gospels of the New Testament.
Wait, I interjected. David was making a bold claim, and I wanted to make sure we were clear.
Are you saying that the Gospels of the New Testament are earlier than all other accounts of Jesus' life?
Yes, all the other accounts of Jesus' life came much later.
But I had heard that there were many other Gospels, and that these were just the ones Christians chose to put into the Bible.
There were other Gospels, to be sure, but they all came much later, in the mid-second century or afterward.
The four Gospels in the New Testament are all first century, right after Jesus. That's one reason why the early Christians chose them.
I tried advancing my case.
But what if the Injil was another Gospel, one revealed to Jesus, and it was lost after his death?
There are at least two critical problems with that, Nabil. First, it's pure conjecture. What if is not much of an argument if there's no evidence.
Second, you know the Quran tells Christians to judge by the Injil. That means they still had it in Muhammad's day. The Injil is not a lost scripture.
I tried to respond, but I couldn't immediately see how to vindicate my position. The more I thought about his argument, the more it left a sour taste in my mouth. Gone was my afterglow.
David continued, "As objective investigators, if we are going to learn about Jesus' life, we must turn to the Gospels, because they are the most likely to be accurate. Where else could we go?"
I sat up to consider this point.
"Well, even if they're the best, that doesn't mean they're any good."
"True. But these books were written shortly after Jesus' crucifixion, in the lifetime of the disciples. That's far better than most other biographies. For example, the main biographies about Alexander the Great were written about 400 years after his death. If we are confident we know anything about Alexander, we should be exponentially more confident in what we know about Jesus."
"Yeah, but being better than other biographies doesn't mean that the Gospels are trustworthy."
"You're not getting me. It's not just that the Gospels are temporally closer to Jesus than other biographies are to their subjects, but they're so close that eyewitnesses were still alive at that time. Given that the Gospels were circulating within Christian communities, the eyewitnesses must have heard them and contributed to them."
I smiled. "That sounds like conjecture to me, David. Where's the evidence?"
"Well, early church fathers record that this is exactly what happened. According to Papias, an author writing around AD 100, the Gospel of Mark is based on Peter's eyewitness testimony. Papias also refers to John and Matthew as disciples. So it's more than conjecture that eyewitnesses contributed to the Gospels. It's recorded history that they actually produced them."
"Well, what about Luke?"
"Luke was Paul's traveling companion, so he wasn't a disciple. But he says at the beginning of his Gospel that he interviewed eyewitnesses, and given that most of what he says agrees with Mark and Matthew, that makes sense."
That sounded weak.
"I don't know. You're admitting Luke wasn't an eyewitness, which is problematic. Plus, I've heard that there are many historical inaccuracies in his Gospel."
David was ready with the response.
"Luke has given us the most historical data, which means he gives people more opportunities to question him. But the more we find archaeologically, the more he is proven accurate. For example, some scholars used to conclude that Luke chapter 3, verse 1, inaccurately named Lysanias the Tetrarch of Abilene. They argue that Lysanias existed 50 years prior, and that Luke mistakenly said he lived during Jesus' time. Christian scholars argued that there very well might have been a second Lysanias, but the skeptical scholars deemed that to be apologetic speculation. It turns out that during an excavation, archaeologists found an inscription dating from the time of Jesus that mentioned a second Lysanias, one who was the Tetrarch of Abila. This proved that skeptics are sometimes too quick to criticize Luke, and that Luke was a reliable source of ancient information. This was all news to me, and it was fascinating, but I did not want to admit, even to myself, that the Gospels were trustworthy. My whole life I had been told that I could not trust them, and it would be shameful for me to admit my teachers were wrong. So I continued to push. "Can we be sure about all this, David? I mean, I haven't seen these inscriptions, and even if I had, I would not be able to test them for authenticity. Plus, I'm not sure how much I can trust church records. They're biased, after all. There's just too much room for doubt."
This seemed to annoy David.
"Look, Nabil, you've studied epistemology. You know that, if you wanted to,
you could doubt that we're even having this conversation, or that we even exist. It's like the Matrix. We could all just be brains in jars, being fed stimuli by mad scientists. You can't disprove that. So it all depends on how skeptical you're willing to be. Feel free to be as skeptical as you want, but just don't be inconsistent. If you're going to be this skeptical about the Bible, I want you to be equally skeptical when we take a look at the Quran. Rallied by the mere hint of a challenge to my faith, I perked up. The Quran can take the highest levels of skepticism, David. It's easy to prove that the Quran has never been changed and comes from Allah through Muhammad himself. Insistent, David responded. Nabil, with the level of skepticism you're proposing today, I'm not sure you could hold to any beliefs. We'll see when we get there. But for now, do you realize we're just working with levels of probability? There's no such thing as absolute certainty, not in the real world.
Yeah, that's true.
Good. So the best explanation by far is that the Gospels are a reliable source for Jesus' life, unquestionably more reliable than anything else we have. Can you at least agree to that? A rift was beginning to form between my heart and my head. What I wanted to believe was fighting a battle with the evidence for the New Testament. I was torn. Stalling, I glanced over at our chemistry assignment, which was on electronegativity and bond strength. It's too bad religion isn't like science. Then we could just demonstrate which claims are true in a lab. I don't know, Nabil. Even science is inductive, relying on observations and best explanations, not always deductive conclusions. I don't think that what we're discussing is too conceptually different. I stared at him incredulously. Now you're just arguing for the sake of arguing. You just want to disagree with me on everything, don't you? David laughed. I hate to say it, but I disagree with that too. Let's just agree to disagree for now. I nodded in affirmation, and with that, we turned our attention to chemistry for the rest of the evening. But in the recesses of my mind, I did not disagree with David. Not really. If his facts were accurate, then his arguments made sense. I could not get myself to concede it, though, because there would be a cost to pay. I'd have to admit that my parents and teachers were wrong about the Bible. But they were so adamant, so devoted to God, so genuine. Could they really be wrong? So, I did not admit to David that his arguments made sense. In fact, I didn't even admit it to myself. Part 4. Coming to the Crux. To have to eat, to grow fatigued, and to sweat and spill blood, and to be finally nailed to a cross. I cannot believe this. God deserves infinitely more. Chapter 24. Litmus Tests. Over the next couple of years, I grew deep roots at ODU. I joined many organizations and honor societies, hoping to get a vibrant college experience and beef up my resume. Apart from membership in a handful of clubs, I became president of the forensics team, overseeing practices and functioning as a liaison with the Office of Student Activities. I also worked in the admissions department, where I made PowerPoint presentations and filled in for tour guides when there were not enough around. Because of my flurry of extracurricular involvement, I made many good friends and was never lacking in companionship. But there was no question about it. David was my best friend throughout college, and I was his. When I was between classes and had nothing to do, or if it was time to grab a meal and no one was around, David was the first one I called. Though I could goof around with most of my other friends, there was no one I connected with as deeply as David. My faith mattered to me, and David's faith mattered to him. That was the level we connected on. A level deeper and more personal than most friendships. Plus, it helped that David and I both spent most of our time in either the science buildings or the arts and letters building. We regularly saw each other and often planned to walk together from our science classes, which tended to be earlier in the day, to our humanities courses. One such route was after chemistry lab. David and I had lab in different rooms, so whenever we met afterward, we would share stories about our exploits. We started off with mere exaggerations, but soon we were weaving impossible tall tales with the goal of outdoing each other's story. The one-upsmanship was meant to be grandiose. On one specific occasion, I had to come up with an impressive feat of acid-base titration. I really enjoyed this topic and grasped it intuitively, probably because we could visually test our progress. In the process of our titrations, if we did not know whether our liquid was acidic or basic, all we had to do was dip litmus paper into it. If the paper came out pink, it was an acid. If the paper came out purple, it was a base. The litmus paper made it easy to know where we were in the process of our overall experiment. After the lab, I waited for David in the courtyard outside. He was late. When he finally walked out of the building, I wasted no time giving him my story. "Dude, it only took me 15 minutes to do my titrations. I didn't even need litmus paper. I just eyeballed it and bam, I was done. I've been waiting for you ever since." "Oh yeah? Well, when I got to the lab, I got a beaker of acid and a beaker of base, and I put them next to each other and commanded them to titrate themselves. They obeyed out of fear and awe, so it only took me 1 minute."
"Uh-huh. So why are you late?"
"Well, it took me an hour to sign autographs for all the professors."
"That's why you're late?"
"That's why I'm late." I picked up my backpack and we started heading toward the Arts and Letters building. We began inventing one whopper after another, trying to get the last word on whose chemistry skills were the most legendary. The walk was short and relaxing, taking us past the large glass windows of the library and a calming fountain by the new broadcasting building. When there was finally a lull in the banter, David's visage slowly grew serious. It seemed to take on a hint of concern. My friend's concern was my concern, so I grew serious too.
"Yo, Dave, what's on your mind?"
"I was just thinking of something. I want to know what you think, but I'd like you to answer me honestly." David didn't usually talk like this, so he had my attention.
"Yeah, man, what's going on?"
"Right now we're goofing off and arguing about who's better at chemistry. It's pointless fun. Don't get me wrong, we're having a blast, and that's great. But the laughs are what we're after. The argument itself is pointless."
I nodded.
"It's also really fun when we talk about the Bible and Christianity. But I wonder if we're not just goofing off and trying to outdo each other there, too. You see what I'm saying?" "I guess I'm wondering if our conversations about faith are more than just fun arguments."
"What do you mean? Of course they are.
Let me put it this way. Let's just say Christianity were true. Just for a moment, imagine with me that Jesus really is God, and that he really did die on the cross for your sins, and that he rose from the dead. He loves you, and he wants you to live your life following and proclaiming him."
"Okay, I'm imagining it. It's hard for me, but I'm trying."
"All right. Now, if it were the case that Christianity were true, would you want to know it?"
"I'm sorry, what?"
I didn't understand what he was asking.
"If Christianity were true, would you want to know it?"
"Why wouldn't I?"
"All kinds of reasons.
For one, you'd have to admit to yourself that you were wrong all these years, and that's not easy. It would also mean you'd have to go back through your entire life and sort out everything you ever thought you knew about God and religion. That's tough, man. I can easily imagine not wanting to do that."
I did not answer immediately, but kept on slowly walking with David. The trees along the path were thinning out as we approached the Arts and Letters building. Squinting as we came out of their shadows, we decided to put our backpacks down by the fountain and take a break. I looked past David, out over the water. After a moment, I responded, "Yes and no." I looked over at David. He waited.
"Yes, I would want to know because I want to know the truth, and I want to follow God. He is the most important thing there is.
But no, I wouldn't want to know because it would cost me my family. They'd lose the son they've always wanted, and they'd lose all the respect they have in the community. If I became a Christian, it would destroy my family. I'm not sure I could live with that. After all they've done for me, no."
The silence that followed was pregnant. The sound of flowing water washed over any awkwardness, and we stood for another few moments, saying nothing. Finally, David asked,
"So who do you think would win?
God or your family?" It was a blunt question, but that's how I needed to hear it.
"God."
Even as I spoke, a wave of defiance swept over me. I came to my senses and turned to David. "But it's not like any of the speculation matters. Christianity is not true. Islam is the truth. Will you be willing to admit it when you realize it, David?"
David looked at me incredulously.
"Nabil, you're doing it again. I hate to say it, but it seems like when we talk about our faiths, you just try to win the argument instead of honestly looking for the truth. It's as if you presuppose that Christianity is false." If anyone else had made these accusations, I probably would have walked away and avoided further discussion. But this was my best friend, and I knew he cared about me. I considered his words carefully.
"Maybe you're right. I don't think Christianity could even possibly be true."
"Well, why not, Nabil? You haven't been able to defend your position in any of our discussions. You thought the Bible had been altered over time, But you weren't able to defend that. You thought it might not be trustworthy, and you weren't able to defend that.
Well, maybe it's because I'm not well-versed in these things. I'm no scholar. I don't know all the answers.
In saying this, a hidden reality was revealed. Western though my upbringing was, it was built upon the eastern bedrock of authority.
David remained focused. What would it take for you to begin to think that Christianity is possibly true?
I reflected on this for a moment before responding.
My dad taught me everything I know about religion, and he knows way more than I do. If I saw that even he could not answer objections, then I would begin to look into things more carefully.
Then you'd think that Christianity is possibly true?
Just possibly.
David considered this.
Do you think your dad would be up for a conversation?
Of course, I answered without hesitation.
I've got a friend, Mike, who holds meetings at his house once a month, where people from all kinds of backgrounds get together and talk about religion. We call them dream team meetings.
I know he'd be willing to have a conversation with your dad. You think that'll work?
Yeah, definitely. I'll check with my dad, but I don't think he'll have a problem with it. Count us in.
Okay, good. Let's pick a topic so we don't go all over the map. What should we discuss?
Well, if there's a litmus test between Islam and Christianity, I think it's the issue of whether Jesus died on the cross.
All right, we'll talk about Jesus' death on the cross. That settles it.
David and I turned back to look over the water, considering the implications of what had just happened. Years later, I would find that this was a major turning point for David. If I had said that I didn't want to know if Christianity was true, David would not have pursued our conversations any further. He had long before realized that people who wanted to avoid the truth usually succeeded. It was a turning point for me, too. Convinced that Abba would be able to deftly handle anything that was thrown his way, I was not prepared for how the conversation would go.
Chapter 25. Crucifying the Swoon Theory. Shortly after the candid conversation by the fountain, I asked Abba if he would be willing to go to meet with Mike and talk about Jesus' death. As expected, Abba responded enthusiastically. Like me, he loved talking about matters of religion because he was convinced of the truth of Islam. He saw every opportunity to discuss our beliefs as an opportunity to honor and glorify God. But because of final exams, family trips, and other obligations, there was no opportunity in the near future for us to go to one of Mike's meetings. It wasn't until my sophomore year that the stars aligned. David and I were taking genetics together, and he told me in class one day that a friend of Mike's was coming to town, someone who had studied the historical Jesus. If we wanted, the five of us could meet over the weekend. It sounded like the perfect opportunity, so I made sure Abba and I were available. Before long, the day we had been waiting for finally arrived. It turned out that the meeting was not far from our house, practically in our own neighborhood. The man hosting the event, Mike Lacona, had been a friend of David's for some time. Formerly a Taekwondo instructor and insurance salesman, he had been studying the New Testament for the past few years. He had recently finished a master's degree in religious studies and was considering a doctorate. When we arrived at his home, he greeted us warmly. At 6'4", he had a rather striking figure, but despite his formidable height and martial arts training, he had kind eyes and a soft voice. Mike introduced us to his friend, Gary, who was also rather imposing. He appeared to be about 5 years older than Abba, with sharp blue eyes and a well-trimmed beard. He looked like a mix between Santa Claus and an offensive lineman. Gary extended his hand to me.
Hi, my name is Gary Habermas. I'm a friend of Mike's, one of his former professors.
Nabil Qureshi, good to meet you.
Thanks for coming to the meeting. I hear you're familiar with the historical Jesus.
Gary chuckled. I guess you could say that. I've written a few books on the topic.
This was my first indication that things might not go so well for me in Abba that night. I decided to ask him some more questions to see whom exactly we had stumbled upon.
David told me you knew the subject well, but I didn't realize you've written books on it.
How long have you been studying the field?
Well, my dissertation was on the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. I wrote it in 1976, and I've been studying the historical Jesus ever since, so that's over 26 years.
Smiling and nodding, I decided to let Abba do most of the talking for the evening.
The five of us continued getting to know one another as we seated ourselves in Mike's living room. Mike sat with his back to the window and Gary at his left. I sat in a recliner facing Mike, with Abba to my right. David sat farther away from us, in an armchair toward the corner of the room. He reined us in when it was time to begin. Well, I'll quickly give some background and then hand it over to Nabil and his dad. We wanted to talk about the crucifixion of Jesus. Nabil and Mr. Qureshi believe Jesus did not die on the cross, whereas the rest of us know that's just not true. Gary's mouth dropped, and I just shook my head. But Abba had met David a few times and knew he was a bit cheeky, so he chuckled, and Mike lightheartedly chided David. Now play nice, David. All right, all right. But you guys think Jesus was crucified, right? Crucified but not killed on the cross? Abba responded, that's right. Mike stepped in. Well, why don't we just start there? Tell us why you think that. With that, Abba and I had the floor. Abba did the lion's share of the talking, mostly arguing the case found in Mirza Ghulam Ahmed's book, Jesus in India. It was the same case I had shared with my friend Kristen years earlier on the school bus, except Abba wove in supplementary arguments. Mike and Gary listened attentively, asking questions only for the sake of clarification. They did not disrupt Abba or interject with refutations, much to David's chagrin. After about half an hour, there was a subtle shift in the mood of the room. Mike and Gary were looking for an opportunity to start responding. When Abba mentioned the Shroud of Turin, Gary piped up. Wait, you think the Shroud of Turin is real? You think Jesus' image is on that shroud? Abba doubled back and considered his claim more carefully. Yes, I do. Why, what do you think? Well, I think there's a lot of good reason to agree with you, but I'm surprised that you think it's Jesus. It's pretty clear the man in the shroud is dead. The imams in our Jamaat proclaim the authenticity of the shroud, but they argue that Jesus was alive when the shroud was placed on him. Having heard some of their arguments, Abba replied, but blood coagulates when a man dies, and the man in the shroud has blood flow. You're right, but the blood flow on the shroud demonstrates a separation of serum and clotted blood, which only happens after death. You also see evidence of rigor mortis, another indication the body is dead. Not being overly familiar with the details of the shroud, Abba decided to stick with the gospel accounts. But even in the Bible, it says that when Jesus' side was pierced, blood and water gushed out. That means that his heart was still pumping. Otherwise, how would blood gush out? Gary shook his head. If his heart was still pumping, what was the water? What the author of the gospel calls water is either the serum after it had separated, or it was fluid from around the heart. Either way, Jesus had to be dead in order for there to be blood and water. Mike had a New Testament in hand and added, the Greek word you're translating as gushed out is the same word for simply coming out. It doesn't mean the heart was pumping. Besides, if you're going to quote John, you've got a bigger problem. John says explicitly that Jesus was dead. See? Chapter 19, verse 33. He was already dead. Abba asked Mike to show him the Bible, and Mike pointed out the verse. It was in Greek, so it couldn't help Abba too much. But Abba continued to look at it, switching back and forth between Mike's Greek New Testament and his own King James. After giving him a moment, Gary spoke up again. I don't think a man could survive the kind of spear wound dealt to Jesus. The very reason they stabbed him in the chest was to make sure he was dead. The spear would have gone into Jesus' heart, killing him instantly. But the Bible didn't say it went into his heart, Abba pressed, just that it pierced his side. Plus, he was only on the cross for a few hours. He could easily survive that. Well, I wouldn't be so sure. There's an entire history of the practice of crucifixion, and I can assure you of this. It wasn't gentle enough to survive. As far as we know, no one in history ever survived a full Roman crucifixion. The Romans designed it to be a humiliating, torturous, surefire method of execution. Are you familiar with the flogging process and the rest of the crucifixion? Abba shook his head. They used what's called a flagrum, a whip that was designed to rip skin off the body and cause excessive bleeding. After just a few lashes, the victim's skin began to come off in ribbons and their muscles tore. After a few more lashes, the muscle became like pulp. Arteries and veins were laid bare. Sometimes the flagrum would reach around the abdomen and the abdominal wall would give way, causing the victim's intestines to spill out. Obviously, many people died during the flogging alone. This was all news to me, and I was horrified. I knew the Bible said Jesus was flogged, but it gave no details. If this was truly the kind of torture Jesus underwent, I was going to have a harder time defending the idea that Jesus survived the cross. But Gary was not done. After the flogging, victims were nailed through their arms to a crossbeam. The nails would go right through the median nerve, causing extreme pain and incapacitating the hands. A 7-inch nail would be driven through both feet, and the crucifixion victim would be made to hang from his arms, a position that makes it nearly impossible to breathe. He would have to use his little remaining energy to push against the nail in his feet so he could breathe out. He could breathe in as he sagged back down, but he would have to push back up before breathing out again. When all his energy was drained, and he could not push up any longer, he would die of asphyxiation. Mike quickly added, "Which is why they broke the legs of the robbers next to Jesus. Without their knees, they couldn't breathe out, so they died." Gary continued, "And that made it pretty easy for the guards to tell when someone was dead. All they had to do was see if a victim stopped pushing up. But the guards developed ways to ensure the victims really were dead. Other than breaking the knees, sometimes they'd crush the victim's head, sometimes they would feed the body to dogs, or, as in the case of Jesus, sometimes they would pierce the victim's heart." With each point, I felt our position becoming more and more problematic, but Abba was not through. "Jesus prayed for the bitter cup to be taken away from him in the Garden of Gethsemane. Clearly, he did not want to die. Would God not honor that?" Mike answered, "Yes, but he also said to God, 'Let your will be done, not mine.' So on the human level of experiencing pain, of course Jesus did not want to be crucified. But on a deeper level, Jesus wanted God's will to be done, and so he was willing to be crucified. He made this clear when he turned back to Jerusalem much earlier in his ministry, prophesying his death and willingly walking toward it." Gary added, "And that's something I wanted to clarify about your position. It looks like you quote the Gospels to help build your case, but that you do not take verses into account that might oppose your view. For example, you quoted the dream that Pilate's wife had, even though it appears only once in one of the Gospels. But you ignore the times Jesus prophesies his death, even though that occurs multiple times in each Gospel. Why is that?" Abba answered honestly, "Because it's not possible that Jesus died on the cross. He was beloved of God, and he cried out to be saved. If there are verses that say he prophesied his death on the cross, those verses must have been added by Christians." I felt my face flush. From my earlier conversations with David, I knew that arguing against the textual integrity of the New Testament was difficult. But that is not what I found embarrassing. Rather, it was clear to me that Abba was cherry-picking verses to defend his views. I decided to speak up. "Abba, I think that they're saying that unless we have good reason to discredit a specific verse, it might be inconsistent to use ones we like and ignore the ones we don't like." Abba turned to me, utterly stunned that I would contravene his authority. He looked betrayed, and I regretted my words. From that point on, he did not say much. I took over the remainder of the conversation, which turned out to be rather brief. "Okay, I hear your case, guys, but I also see there's room for doubt. Are there scholars that agree with Abba and me that Jesus did not die on the cross?" Mike responded, "Well, in the 1700s, some scholars started suggesting that Jesus did not die on the cross, but the theory was short-lived. David Strauss, a highly respected non-Christian scholar, argued a key point. Not only was Jesus' survival of the cross highly implausible, it would have nipped the Christian movement in the bud. You see, the disciples went from being afraid of associating with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane to being willing to die for proclaiming him the risen Lord. If Jesus had just barely survived the crucifixion, he would have come to them broken and on the verge of dying. That is not the kind of appearance that would inspire a total transformation and a disregard for death. That boldness was the ethos of the early Christian movement, and without it, there would be no Christianity." Gary added, "These are just some of the reasons why virtually no scholar in the field denies Jesus' death on the cross. In fact, the opposite is true. Most scholars agree that they can be more assured of Jesus' death by crucifixion than of anything else in his life." I pushed, "You're talking about Christian scholars, right?" "Christian, non-Christian, you name it. And like I said, there are other reasons, all compelling. For example, there are multiple non-Christian sources from the first century after Jesus who testify to Jesus' death on the cross. And there are many more Christian sources that confirm it. Plus, there's no tradition to the contrary, not for a long time. But to answer your question, I'm talking about virtually everyone." Mike added the last word, "Scholars are virtually unanimous. The death of Jesus on the cross is among the surest facts of history." I let these words sink in. Soon, Abba indicated that it was time to leave. I wanted to stay and talk some more, but Abba was firm. The silence during the ride home served to echo Mike's concluding words. It seemed to me that if I wanted to hold on to an Islamic view of Jesus' crucifixion, whether through the substitution theory or the theistic swoon theory, I would have to discard history. The Quran required me to close my eyes to the evidence and believe solely on faith. Here were the results of our litmus test, and there were no shades of gray. The Christian claim aligned with the evidence 100%. But what was worse? I had seen Abba refuted. For one reason or another, he had elected to ignore an obvious truth during our conversation, and that did not sit well with me at all. I realized I could no longer uncritically trust what my parents had taught me. I did not doubt their sincerity, their devotion, or their love, but I was beginning to doubt their grasp of the truth. It was as if, rather suddenly, a veil of certainty was lifted, and I was seeing the potential of the world in a new light. It was like I had been wearing colored glasses my entire life, and they had been taken off for the first time. Everything looked different, and I wanted to examine it all more carefully. Maybe, just maybe, I should start considering it a remote possibility that the Christian message could possibly be true. Chapter 26. A Muslim at Church. When we arrived home, Ami met us at the door. She was curious to know how the meeting went. I debriefed her on our conversation, emphasizing that we were able to get our point across. But given that Abba was still hesitant to speak, and that I was anxious to leave the room, I doubt she was convinced. As soon as I could, I excused myself and made my way upstairs. The room at the end of our upstairs hallway was originally designed to be a large closet or laundry room. But when Abba had the house built, he asked the builders to extend it into a full-sized bedroom. He made it his library, lining the walls with bookcases, each full to the brim. Whenever I wanted to study literature on religion, I would go to the appropriate section of Abba's bookcase, pick out some books, and flop down on my stomach to start reading. It was something I often did for fun. But I was not thinking about fun that day. I was on a mission to resolve the tension that was growing in my heart and mind. I pulled out the books we had about Jesus, almost all of which were written by Muslim authors and scholars. I began systematically sifting through the literature, looking for information that I could use to respond to what I had just heard. It was then that I noticed something for the first time. The books Abba had on Jesus' life were all polemical. They started with a conclusion, found facts that supported their position, and then made their case. As Gary had pointed out about Abba's argument, the treatments were not careful or fair. They did not grapple with counter-arguments, which left the cases they made untested and brittle. Even though I had seen our arguments fail multiple times, I now became convinced it was because we had poor methodology. Eastern authors were able to make passionate cases that compelled the heart, but Western authors thought more systematically and linearly, equipping themselves with excellent counter-arguments and more tempered positions. Perhaps if I employed Western methodology with Eastern passion, I would be able to craft the most compelling and defensible case of all. It was time to become more systematic about my approach, but I had no idea how to start. Just then, David called. I flipped open my phone. "Nabil," he started cheerfully. "What did you think of the conversation?" "I'm still processing it. I think I need to learn about methodology."
"Oh yeah? How?"
"I don't know. You got any ideas?"
"Actually, yeah. I noticed you didn't want to leave at the end of the conversation, so I asked Mike and Gary if they had another opportunity to talk. Turns out they were planning on doing lunch tomorrow, and they wouldn't mind having us along. It'll be after church, where Gary is the guest preacher. Want to join us?"
"You could ask them all about historical methodology and..."
"Whoa, wait." My brain did not compute his suggestion. "You want me to come to church with you?"
"If you want."
"And what would I tell my parents?"
"What do you mean?" I tried to talk some sense into him. "You think they're going to let me go to church with you, so I can talk with Mike and Gary? Not after today."
"Take your thumb out of your mouth, grow some chest hair, and just tell them. You're an adult, for crying out loud."
I sighed, exasperated. "You don't understand. It's much more complicated than that." To my parents, a second meeting could indicate that I was beginning to give Mike and Gary a place of authority in my life. This would be especially true if I didn't bring Abba with me to the meeting. But bringing him was out of the question. I wouldn't be able to speak freely if he were to come along. I did not want to give them cause for undue concern, and honestly, I didn't want to give them the opportunity to tell me I couldn't go. I decided to tell my parents I was going to hang out with David, which was the truth, but not the whole truth. Over the following years, there were a few more occasions when I had to test my moral compass by navigating between full and partial truths for the sake of a higher good. I never liked it, but I otherwise felt stuck between a rock and a hard place. I went to David's house the next day, and he drove me to his church. It was a college church called Campus Impact, and it was a totally new experience for me. They had what they called a worship team on stage, singers in a band that played guitars, drums, and other instruments as people clapped and sang along. There were humorous announcements, a brief break during which people seemed coerced to greet one another, and a bucket that people passed along to collect money. I had never seen any of this before, and it all seemed very irreverent to me. Worship was supposed to be a solemn, reflective time of bonding between man and God, yet these people were banging on drums and asking for money. At the mosque, no one was allowed to stand in front of you while you worshipped, so that you could focus on worshipping God. That there were girls on stage during a worship service seemed to border on sacrilege. So the worship service disturbed me and left a sour taste in my mouth. I thought, if this is what it means to worship God as a Christian, I want nothing to do with it. For me, the sermon was the main event. When it came time for Gary to speak, he delivered a sermon on immortality. He argued that Jesus' resurrection was a historically verifiable event, and that the implications were tremendous. It meant that life does not end when we die, that we are immortal. This was cause either to rejoice or to be gravely concerned, depending on what life after death might hold. But according to Gary, Jesus' resurrection also answered this question. It meant that the Christian message was true, and that we could know we would be in heaven forever with God if we trusted Jesus as our Lord and Savior. That is where my Muslim mind took issue with Gary. Yes, God makes us, in a sense, immortal. Though our bodies will die, our souls will never cease to be. But even if Jesus had already been raised from the dead, that didn't make everything else about Christianity automatically true. After church, we went to a restaurant called The Max, and I made that very point between bites of salad. Gary, let's say the resurrection of Jesus actually happened. That doesn't all of a sudden mean that we ought to accept him as our Lord and Savior. That just means he was raised from the dead. Yes, but you have to start asking the question. Why? Why did he die on the cross, and why was he raised? Gary paused to let me process. Then he continued. Plus, you have to grapple with the fact that this man is obviously telling the truth about himself. What truth? I asked, breaking away from the food. That he is divine. Wait a minute, that's a whole separate issue. I don't think Jesus claimed to be God. Gary gave a slight nod. Fair enough. But you'd at least agree with this. If Jesus was raised from the dead, then that means God has his stamp of approval on Jesus. Yes, of course, but I already believe that God approves of Jesus. David interjected. Nabil, just yesterday you said you wanted to learn methodology, which means you want to be more objective in your research and argumentation, right? Absolutely. Then, I already believe something is not a good reason to continue believing it. You need better reasons, ones that are grounded in objective facts. If the resurrection happened, we have good reason to believe that God approves of Jesus. That's the point. I turned back to Gary. Okay, I get it. But so what? What does that mean for me? Even though the question was directed at Gary, David continued. It means you should look and see if Jesus really did claim to be God. Okay, I want to do that, but how? And that's my main question here. How can I investigate this stuff more or less objectively? How should I go about this methodologically? Mike, who had been mostly listening up to this point, perked up. I've actually been working on a book, one that Gary and I will be publishing together, where we address that very question in regard to Jesus' resurrection. Historians carefully use criteria and techniques when investigating the past. Their systematic approach is called the historical method. Mike began to lay out some of the basic criteria of the historical method, such as the criterion of multiple attestation and the criterion of early testimony. What I began to notice was that the historical method is mostly about being fair, careful, and using common sense. Wrapping up the discussion, Mike had one final point. Nabil, the most important thing is that you have to be consistent when you do your research. Read both sides of an argument. Don't agree with any theory before you test a few. See which argument addresses the most facts and issues, how well it addresses them,
and how important those facts and issues are to the overall argument. Ultimately, that's how we find the best explanation of the past. This term intrigued me. The best explanation? I asked. Yes, that's what studying history is all about. There will always be competing theories, and no theory about the past is ever perfect. But there is often a best explanation, and sometimes it far exceeds all the others. In the case of the events surrounding Jesus' death, the best explanation is that he rose from the dead, and this far exceeds all other theories. I was processing this information in my head, determining how I would apply it. All right, I think it's coming together. Here's what I want to do. I want to put the main issues of Christianity and Islam into historically investigable terms, so that I can determine which one is more likely to be true. So tell me if you agree with this. If we can determine that Jesus claimed to be God, and that he died on the cross, and that he rose from the grave, then that would be a good case for Christianity. The three of them nodded. I continued. But if we can determine that Jesus did not die on the cross, and that he did not rise from the dead, or that he did not claim to be God, then I would have good reason to think Christianity is false. Do you agree? David asked for clarification. Are you saying all three must be false in order to disprove Christianity? I shook my head. No. If any one of those three arguments is not compelling, the whole case is not compelling. For example, so what if Jesus claimed to be God and then died on the cross? There are many people who claim to be God and end up dying. But if he rose from the dead after that, now that's something. At that, Gary asked, well, we already talked about Jesus' death on the cross yesterday. What do you think? Do you think the case is strong? I think it's strong enough that I'm going to look into his resurrection and deity for now. I might revisit his death on the cross later. Mike smiled. I'm really glad you're using your mind to be careful and intentional about your faith. Too many people stick with what their parents taught, or go with the flow, or worse, become bitter. You give me hope, Nabil. I'm glad to know you. I smiled back. Mike and Gary were nice guys. They didn't try to push me to believe one thing or another, nor did they seem to think of me as an outsider, as that Muslim boy. I was like them, someone who was pursuing God and truth with all his heart and mind. And now, I had found the path of my pursuit. Assess the historical case for Jesus' death, his deity, and his resurrection. If these three arguments were strongly evidenced, then there would be a strong case for Christianity. If not, then the case would be poor. Other factors, like my opinion of church services, were irrelevant. We finished our lunch, said our goodbyes, and parted ways. I would not see Gary or Mike again until a great Muslim debater came to town more than a year later. His objective? To argue against Jesus' resurrection in front of hundreds. His opponent? My new friend Mike. Chapter 27. Debating the Resurrection. The debate had been requested by Muslim organizations, so it was heavily advertised at the Norfolk Mosque. Posters had been up for weeks, flyers were distributed, and a buzz of excitement permeated conversations. This was going to be a great opportunity to see a Muslim scholar, a sheikh, challenge Christian arguments. That Mike himself was the debate opponent made this scenario almost too good to be true. Would the arguments he shared with me and Abba for the death of Jesus hold up under the scrutiny of a Muslim scholar? The Muslim debater was a well-known apologist who hailed from Toronto, named Shabir Ali. He had a congenial stage presence that made me especially appreciative of him. His gentle demeanor helped combat the violent post-9/11 stereotype of Muslims, which I felt was the best approach. All the same, he boldly wore his Muslim skullcap, a thick black beard, and flowing garb typical of Muslim cultures. Even though he was not Ahmadi, he espoused some Ahmadi arguments, making him the perfect debater, in my estimation. David had the privilege of chauffeuring Shabir around town before the debate. Shabir asked David if they could watch Mel Gibson's new movie, The Passion of the Christ, so the two of them watched it together before David brought him to the venue for that evening's debate at Regent University. Since Shabir had to freshen up, David arrived extra early and reserved the best seats in the house. Gary was back in town for the debate, and I bumped into him in the foyer before the event started. Soon, with David on my left, Gary on my right, and 700 spectators surrounding us, the debate was underway. Mike was an engaging speaker, and he started by sharing that he went through a period of time where he tested his beliefs,
not simply accepting what his parents believed, but rather seeking to find the truth about life and God. The information he was